Good evening. My name is Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. Scott, when I said I wanted a long introduction, I was just kidding. Just kidding. Thank you. Some of these sponsees take everything so literally. Thank you, Carol, for your signing. And it's a lot of work, I know. If you get ahead of me, just know, let me know, and I'll try to catch up. I thank the committee for having Barbara and I here tonight and for bringing us in from Stockbridge. 29.6 miles. Also want to tell the committee I saved you a lot of money. She wanted to fly. I said, no, we'll drive. If you missed last night's speakers, you really missed a good evening. It's really enjoyed John and Kathy, except there was one part of John's story that I found quite troubling, really, and thought about it all the way home. And then later, he was talking about meditation and that his expectations had been a little bit disappointed because he thought maybe it was going to be like a low-grade orgasm. And I thought, as I was going home, what the hell is a low-grade orgasm? And I kept trying to come up with something. I thought, I don't know, maybe a 10-foot bungee jump or something like that. After I thought about it for a little while, I thought, I could have saved myself a lot of trouble. I could have just rolled over and asked Barbara. Just kidding, honey. So it's probably not a good time to introduce her to the audience, so I'll wait. Anyway, it's good to be here, and it's good to be sober. And I need to get into this thing and try to get this over with in a timely manner. If you're new to this fellowship and this program, you're the reason I came. I don't need to come up here and do this for people who have been around for a while. I think it's mostly for the newcomers. I know the stories that I heard when I was new were the ones that gave me a little bit of hope. Maybe think maybe this thing really does work. And so that's why I'm here tonight. I'm supposed to talk in a general manner about what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I noticed that one of the speakers last night called himself, said what it was like, and I did that for a long time and think it was a big deal. And had a cryptic email from an old-timer in Southwest Georgia who later became a friend, but he said, you're misquoting the big book. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, some newcomers here, and we were listening to one of your CDs, and you're saying what it was like, it's what we were like. And apparently my apology didn't have the ring of genuine sincerity to it. And he said, well, you know, it's important, you know, if we'd been old-timers, don't like to hear that. And if we'd been sitting on the front row, we'd have probably got up and walked out, thinking, you know, that if you're going to misquote the big book at the beginning, the rest of the message can't be worth too much. And I said, well, trying to be a little more humble and a little more apologetic, I said, well, you know, that would be okay. I don't think I'd burst into tears at the podium. But I said, maybe it's worth remembering that when we read How It Works, it doesn't say, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly memorized this book. And we were over in England not too long ago, and Burns B. was speaking over there. I hadn't heard him for a long time. Love him to death. Love him to death. He's from Kentucky. He was the only one in England that I really understood. And but he commented from the podium. He said, you know, there's a difference between being a big book thumper and a big book lawyer. And I thought, you know, that's a good point. But I've never said what it was like since then, so I guess the point was taken. I mix the order up a little bit. I start with what happened. And we'll tell you that on, well, first of all, I'll get some stuff out of the way. March 7th, 1990 is my sobriety date. And I remember getting to treatment, and people were saying, well, you know, if you can't remember your sobriety date, maybe you haven't had your last drunk. Or you haven't had your last drunk, maybe can't remember it, maybe you haven't had it. And I thought, well, I don't know how much of a problem it is for most people, but I had Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings all telling the world about mine, so it's never been a problem for me to remember that particular time. But I usually talk about 3 days that are pretty intense, March 7th, 8th, and 9th. And those days, even as the years have melted away, those days have remained very intense, and I hope they never lessen, because I never want to forget those days. And I can really look at my watch on any one of those days and know exactly where I was that particular time and that particular day and what was going on. And that's a gift that I can do that, because the memories are quite vivid. On March the 8th, an incident took place that had never come to the public's attention before, and that was that three airline pilots were arrested for having flown drunk. And I'm going to talk about being an airline pilot only because it's part of the story. Typically, we don't do that from the podium because we're talking about recovery. It really doesn't make any difference what we did for a living. But because of what I did for a living, the consequences were extraordinarily severe, and the media attention was just relentless. I'll make it clear that I'm not an airline pilot who's a drunk. I'm a drunk who got to be an airline pilot through a lot of good fortune. And I don't believe we have any prestige or status in this fellowship, so what I did has nothing to do with the story except for the fact that it's one of the details in the story. I don't believe that we rise to anything greater in this fellowship than the status of being sober. I don't believe there's any celebrity status. I don't believe there's anybody that's more important than anybody else. And I keep waiting for that email saying, well, we just broke ground on the AA Hall of Fame, so shoot that theory down. But I won't talk much about the flying. I will share one quick little thing with you that I was told back in 1961 when I first began flying, and it saved my life many, many times. It's a very simple statement. Airplanes, for specific aerodynamic reasons, take off and land into the wind. And I was told to always remember this, that it was better to break ground and fly into the wind than it was to break wind and fly into the ground. And I can't tell you how many times that saved my life. On the morning of March the 8th, 1990, an event took place that had never come to the public's attention before, as I said, and that was that three airline pilots were arrested for flying drunk, and I was the captain of that crew. I can tell you from the moment I walked off the airplane and I saw what was transpiring, I knew my life was over. Northwest Airlines was the only major carrier at that time that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. All the rest of them had good programs in place for many years. Going back to the mid-70s, but Northwest had steadfastly refused to join the rest of the carriers. And I had seen guys at Northwest get in trouble for drinking. About every 5, 6, 7 years, there would be a big incident, and those pilots were fired. They never came back. It was instant, it was swift, and there was no recourse. And even worse than that was all those names were remembered by the rest of the pilots on our own little individual halls of shame. And I remembered the names. I knew where the incidents had occurred. And I knew that's where my name was going to go. And I had not lived my life, I didn't think, in such a way as to watch it end like that. That was not supposed to be the legacy I left behind me. I tried for some time, really, to find the words to describe the shame that instantly penetrated me when I walked off the airplane within seconds. And the big book says it so beautifully and succinctly when it talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I don't think it can be said any better than that. And we were detained for 12 hours that day. We were questioned by Airline Pilot Association attorneys, Northwest Airlines attorneys, We were escorted to two medical facilities by uniformed police, and at one of those facilities, a reporter saw uniformed cops and uniformed airline pilots, and that's how the story broke to the public. Now, I knew this thing was going to sweep the airline like wildfire, but I had no idea at that moment in time that it was going to go all the way around the world and stay on the news for weeks and weeks and weeks. As a matter of fact, I get a little antsy when I was sitting out there last night. I saw the film stuff up here, and I thought, man, I've been on TV way more than I wanted to be. And as a matter of fact, you know, I used to see a little brief clip that the media settles on. They always do. They may take 10 miles of film, but they settle on one like Monica and Clinton in the Rose Garden and Michael Jackson waving from the top of the car or whatever it was. And they had settled on one with Barbara and me and my attorney walking into the courthouse, turning a corner and going into the courthouse, followed by the other two defendants and their attorneys. And used to see that quite a bit on A&E or Discovery Channel when they do a segment on transportation industry and alcohol and drugs. And it always evoked a little bit of pain, and I commented about it one time, and Barbara said, yeah, she shared that. And I said, really? Because she had never said anything to me about it. And I said, well, what is it? When you watch that, what is it that strikes you? And she said, well, they show that same clip over and over and over. And she said, I just know everybody in the country is going to think I only have that one dress. I had tears in my eyes. But it was a lengthy day that day, and there were times when I really went through this surreal thing of believing that I was watching this happen to somebody else. This couldn't be happening to me. It couldn't be happening to me. And yet it was. And then I'd look around and I'd just get gut sick and heart sick. For 12 hours that took place. And I got home the next morning. Had forgotten that I was supposed to be back home that evening. The day was so full of trauma that it hadn't occurred to me. And Barbara waited out here at the Atlanta airport for 4 hours. And I never showed up. And when I finally had a chance to call, she was still gone, and I heard my voice on the answering machine. I thought, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say to her. And all I could say was, there's been a disaster. I think I've lost my job, and I'll be in on the first flight in the morning. I made it back in the first flight in the morning. I've never told a story, but I haven't said that. I stepped outside, and I saw her parked over waiting for me, and I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car with her. I was so ashamed. And she and I had been married a long time, and I couldn't look at her. And all I could say is, honey, I'm so sorry. And she's got a very soft South Texas voice, except when she's yelling at me. And she said, who better than I could possibly understand how you feel right now? We drove home in silence, which was a gift. I didn't want to talk about it. Don't know why she didn't ask me or press me a little bit. Husband just told her that he'd lost an airline career. And she was content to let it lie at that. We drove home and she went to work. I went inside the house and could not stay still. I picked up the phone and I called a doctor, the only doctor I knew at the time. He was a family therapist. And I just said to him, you know, I've had something happen. I got to declare an emergency. I need to come in and see you right away. And he cleared his calendar. And within a few minutes, I was in his office. And I can still see the office, the colors of the walls, and how it was laid out. And I walked in and I told him what had happened, straight out. And this look of very stunned shock and surprise on his face. And he kept shaking his head and he just said, Lyle, he said, this is absolutely horrible. He said, just horrible. And he started to go around his desk and he stopped and he looked at me, turned to his left and looked at me and he said, but maybe this is what had to happen. And I didn't understand that comment. There would be another one made later by Barbara that I couldn't fathom or understand either. And I was so shredded that I couldn't even attempt to process it or think about it or figure it out. He came back shortly thereafter and he said, I've just called a doctor. He said, I was on staff with him some years back. And he said, he wants to see you tonight. This is now March the 9th. It's a Friday. And he said he wants to see you at 6 o'clock tonight, and I remember that thing. That struck me. That conveyed a certain sense of urgency to me, the 6 o'clock time. And Later, when I talked with him about it, he said, "We were concerned. Based on your appearance, we thought you very well might be a suicide." I don't know what I looked like. I know what I felt like. And that was probably getting pretty close. Barbara and I drove over to the doctor's office, clear across Atlanta. This doctor, he told me also, he was quite prominent here in Atlanta. He's deceased now, but was a psychiatrist, was himself a recovering alcoholic and cocaine addict, and he was certified in addiction medicine, which I had never, ever heard of. I did not know there was such a thing. We drove over there, and the entire meeting is a blackout to me. I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for 2 days, but I have no recall of that meeting, no memory of it. What I remember is this, that I was completely, totally, absolutely defeated. I was beaten. And so when he asked me a question, I gave him a straight answer as best I could. I didn't get cute. I didn't try to cut corners. I just told him. At some point, and I don't know if it was 10 minutes into the meeting or an hour into the meeting, he looked at me and he said, "Lyle, you're an alcoholic and you need to get into treatment tonight." The other thing that I remember significant about that was that I had no reaction to it. And I've hated alcoholics. I'm going to talk about two parents who died from this disease. Alcoholism in a native community. I'd seen it everywhere. And I hated alcoholics. And he just told me I was an alcoholic. And I didn't feel anything and I didn't react. And I think probably at some level in the 24 hours since the arrest, I knew. I knew. Not consciously, certainly, but I knew that my entire life up to this point was destroyed because I couldn't quit drinking alcohol. And I was doing it in a place and at a time that I had no control over. I looked at him and I said, "I just got home today." I said, "What I'd like to do," I said, "I don't mind going into treatment, but I said, what I'd like to do is go home, please. Let Barbara hang on to me. Let my mind uncoil. Let me just absorb what's happened. And I said, then I'll go into treatment." He said, "You need to go into treatment tonight." And I looked at him and I said, "Okay." My first lesson of willingness. And I said, "Okay." He drew directions back to a treatment center across Atlanta again, a place that I'd never heard of, had no reason to know anything about it. It's located 2.5 miles from the Atlanta airport, a place called Anchor Hospital. We drove back following the directions. Of course, it was dark, and we made the final turn to Anchor. As we did so, the lights swept a sign there that was no longer there now, but at the time it said, "Anchor Hospital, Hospital for Alcoholism and Other Chemical Dependencies." And I hit the brakes and stopped, and the sign was right in front of me. And I looked at it, and I thought, my God, 51 years old, and this is how my life ends. A treatment center for alcoholics. The last place on earth I ever thought I would be. And for just a couple of microseconds, I suppose, I had a quick flashback of my life history, the trophy moments that I had, and I had a number of them. The things that I thought really made me who I was, who gave me a definition, a reputation, defined me. Most of them done against the odds. And it was suddenly as though somebody had taken a giant eraser and they were all gone. Never even existed, maybe. And I had no value. I had no personal worth. Later, I saw a report a few years later. The summarizing paragraph written by this doctor was, "Given the history and background of this man, it was unlikely to believe that he would ever be a productive member of society." And I had gone far and done much. And I remember looking at that paragraph thinking, my God, that's pretty dismal. And then I thought, well, he got all of his information from me. We started down the hill into this treatment center. And suddenly I remembered, this is March the 9th. This is my 27th wedding anniversary. First time that day I'd had a chance to really think about it. And I said to Barbara, I said, "Hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh?" And here came the second comment that I could not fathom or process that day. And very softly she said, "Might be the best one we ever had." And I thought, who could think that? Who could think that at a moment like this? And I didn't respond. Now, on a little bit lighter note, a year ago, we were having an anniversary, and one of the sponsees came by to just surprise us and wish us well. And he said, "Well, what do you guys think the secret is to having been married so long?" And before I had a chance to say anything, Barbara said, "I think it's mostly due to the fact that I never stand to admit I made a mistake." It's an ego-deflating program, and she takes her job very, very seriously. I headed down the hill into the treatment center, wondering, what is this going to be like? And I think I'll stop and come back and just kind of catch up here a little later on. And I'll tell you that I was born in Wichita, Kansas, September of 1938, so I'm going to be 71 very shortly. I don't have any trouble with the number, except I feel like I'm about 35. And I always tell them how I tell the audience how old I am, because it's I don't know about you, but I sit out there and try to figure it out. And and the women are really the ones that are the worst, because they just drop these little cookie crumb hints around. Well, I got out of college. I was probably 22. It was 2 years before Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. I'm going, when was that? Then I was 23 and had our second child the year after the Kennedy assassination. By the time she's done, I've got it narrowed down. I'm going, she's either 43 or 71. It's, so I just get it out of the way. I was born into a very blue-collar family, two very hard-working, good, decent parents. I hesitate to say we were poor. If I'm on a reservation speaking someplace and there are 10 roofs and no electricity or water, I wasn't poor by those standards, but we didn't have anything. We were always scrambling. Everything we owned was third rate, broken, patched, taped, wired, fixed somehow or other, and we were always hurting. But my parents were two very good, hardworking folks, and they showed me through their living example what a good work ethic is. Now, they both died of alcoholism. But I never come to the podium without acknowledging the debt I owe them, because they were not drunk all the time. And during my childhood years, my early childhood years, they gave me much and they taught me much. And I have some good genes from them in addition to the others that I've got. So I am very indebted to my parents for the good years that we had. We lived on the southeast edge of Wichita in a World War II housing project called Plainview. It was a temporary quartered thing, not designed to last, but it's still there today. And I remember being very happy. It was a very economically depressed area, very diverse. There were blacks and whites and Hispanics, a small Native American community. And I was part of that Native American community. And I'm an ethnic mix of several different things. A couple of them are relatively benign when I drink, but the two that always show up with me at the bar, the Comanche and Irish parts. And I'm not a boring drinker. I will have an adventure before the night is over. And I thought it was a pretty good combination. I liked the Irish stuff and the freedom songs and rebel songs and drinking songs, and I had all the albums at home and knew all the artists, knew the songs, and I knew where these places were around the country when I was flying, and I'd go there, Live Irish Entertainment, whether it was in Boston or Washington, D.C., and Chicago or these other places. I loved it. And I would literally be the last one out the door, and I'd be sitting there singing along with a Wild Colonial Boy and the Black Velvet Band and Spancel Hill and Woods of Wexford. Oh, man, I just went on and on and on. Loved it all. And then I might be someplace else, and the other side would kick in. And I'd think to myself, I think I'll have a couple of drinks and just go kill some white people. And that kicks in when I'm in Billings, Montana, in the middle of those cowboy bars. That's bad timing. my parents, the drinking really destroyed the family by the time I was 14, just ripped it apart. I'm fortunate because there was never any domestic violence, and I hear that a lot in our stories. There was no domestic violence. Never saw my dad beat my mom. There was not even a lot of really loud screaming and yelling. So what was there? There was that constant, palpable feeling of chaos just beneath the surface. I never knew what was going to happen next. I couldn't bring friends home because one of them would be drunk and embarrass me. And the drinking got worse and worse and worse. And they got their first divorce when I was 14. By the time I graduated high school, about 3 years later, plus or minus, each one of them had been married and divorced two more times. Now, the divorce really affected me. And I didn't like step-parents, didn't like step-siblings. And I look back and I think I had basically two reactions or emotions, I think, when I was young. I was either really, really laughing or I was really angry. And I got into fights and clashes with step-parents and step-siblings. I wouldn't know any of those folks if they were in the room tonight. I don't remember them. But what would happen was there would be some disruption and I would go to the other family for a little while and live over there until something happened over there, and then I would go back again and the faces and the names would change. I graduated from high school when I was 17. I had the ability to be a good student, but nobody cared, nobody watched, and I took full advantage of that as a kid, and I squandered a lot of academic opportunity. I think my senior year I had a typing class and three study halls. So I wasted a lot of time. A lot of opportunity. I was an athlete, probably average at best, but I thought I was pretty good. And when I graduated from high school at age 17, most people from my part of the city did not go to college. They married their little high school sweethearts and off they went to work for Boeing, Beech, Cessna, or some of the other aircraft factories that were there at the time. And I didn't have that goal in mind. I didn't even have a girlfriend, so I had decided I was going to join the Marine Corps. And shortly after I turned 18, I did. I found me a Marine Corps recruiter. I'd spent an evening the night before listening to one of my buddies who'd come back from Marine boot camp. And we sat there drinking beer for 3 or 4 hours. And these were nonstop sadistic stories about what Marine DIs do to their recruits. I mean, I was hanging on every word. Oh, God, the stories were horrible. And I just thought, man, I just can't wait to go try that. And so I found me a recruiter within a couple of days, and off I went. Now, my story is going to be a little bit different in several regards. First of all, I'm not going to get into a big drunk-a-lot because I don't have time for it. I really don't. I drank pretty much like you did. I had a lot of blackouts. I lost cars. I woke up places I didn't know where I was or how I got there. I had two DUIs that were spread by about 5 or 6 years. But not so content with a DUI, I got an FUI. And I know how alcoholics think. Let me tell you, that's flying under the influence. Carries a little bit heavier penalty. But I won't do a drunk log. I'm going to talk more about the positive side of this. Also, you won't hear me say that I never fit in or belonged. You also won't hear me say that I took that first drink and everything happened for me at that time. I didn't like the way it tasted. I always drank for effect. I liked the way it made me feel. I liked the way it let me do things. But I didn't really equate it with any kind of a magical transformation early on. You know, this is a progressive disease. And it took a little while for it to work its way with me, fortunately. But I told you I've got a good work ethic, so I'll stay with something until I get to where I'm supposed to be. But I went into the Marine Corps. Once I got over the culture shock, I liked it. I did belong. I did fit in. This was an extremely intense environment, Marine boot camp. And so I went at it and found that this was where I really wanted to be. And I found a home. I was going to stay in the Marine Corps. The competition was fierce. It was intense. The camaraderie was just unbelievable. And I was excelling. I just didn't want to wash out. Just didn't want to not complete. At the end of the 13 weeks, there were 70 of us in this boot camp platoon. The drill instructors called out three names, the three top guys. And to my surprise, my name was the number two guy called. I hadn't set out for that, and I was really surprised. But I was extraordinarily proud. I'd never done anything like that before. And so the three of us got a PFC stripe. Now, that's hardly heavy rank, but it was for me. I couldn't take my eyes off my sleeves, so I just kept looking down and going, wow, private first class. Wow. Because the other 67 guys just had slick sleeves. And so I went to Camp Pendleton, and I remember being there one night. I was inside because I was acting corporal of the guard. It was raining. All my buddies were outside and in the rain. And I looked over. There's a lieutenant's uniform hanging up over there. And I remember looking at that thinking, man, at the rate I'm moving up, general can't be too far away. And this is a good place for me to be. So I liked it. I loved it. I'd found where I belonged. I'd found my home. 4.5 years later, I came walking in. Now, I'm drinking. But you can't pull me out of the crowd, and you couldn't pull me out of the crowd for a good long while because of the drinking environment I was in. I was a Marine. I was supposed to be able to drink. And later, I was a fighter pilot. I was supposed to be able to drink. But 4.5 years later, I came walking in. My company commander said, I want you to know that you're the only guy in the unit who has the qualifying scores to participate in a brand new program called Marine Aviation Cadet. If you can pass the test, you can go fly. And I'd always wanted to fly, but that was not on any kind of life radar scope that I had. Because pilots, from my perspective, came from higher places than I came from. They came from wealthy families, from well-educated, college-educated places. They lived in different parts of the town than I lived in. They had a lot of stuff going for them. They didn't come from a background like I had. But he's telling me that if I go test, I might be able to get in this program. So I went and tested. It was an all-day thing, and I passed. I came back, and he said, well, I need to also tell you that about half the people that go into this program aren't going to make it, and I've never been able to handle failure well. It's not something that was put on me by my parents. I don't know where it came from. I just don't like to fail. And I could clearly see that I was on the high probability and statistically of not making it. Because he said only a few of you, very few of you, are coming in from the enlisted side. The rest of the people, 98%, 99%, coming in from the civilian side, and they've all got to have 2 years college minimum, and most of them are going to have more than that. And those will be the people you will be competing with. So it was clear to me that I was in the high-risk area of not making it. And so I thought about it a little bit, decided, no, I want to fly. I'll try. So I went into this flight training program, and there were four phases to it at that point in time. It was an 18-month, very intense, rapid-paced program. And through all four phases, I always ended up as a number two guy. Don't know why, don't know how. Never became cocky or complacent or overconfident. First time it happened, I was convinced it was administrative error. Somebody jumbled test scores someplace somehow, but I was just going to let it ride. I never believed I was as good as my grades indicated. I was watching my friends wash out weekly, sometimes daily. Never forget the looks on their faces. They came over with their sea bag over their shoulder, their heads averted, their eyes averted, because sometimes they had tears in their eyes, telling me that they were leaving and I would never see them again, and their dreams to fly flying were gone. They weren't going to happen. And I thought, one of these days they will get me. It will happen to me someday, somewhere along the way here. So I never let go of that fear of failure. Last 6 months, I left the Florida area and I went to Beeville, Texas for advanced jet flight training. Now, I'm drinking hard and heavy right now, but I also have something I've got to do, and I'm managing my drinking. When I drink, it blows out. I go all out, but I quit drinking. Saturday night's it for me. Sunday, I'm getting well, I'm studying, and I'm getting prepped up for the coming week. Because I am going to complete this program. And drinking has not taken that away from me yet. We get to Beeville, Texas. The first night I'm in town, I hook up with a bunch of my buddies. It was a Friday night. We go to the Officers Club and get drunk. And they said, let's go in. There's a place in downtown called Kane's Drive-In. It's an old-fashioned drive-in. That's where the good-looking South Texas girls hang out. And they like us cadets because we're going to be pilots and we are good marrying potential. And I'd never been very gutsy with the girls, and I thought, okay, well, I'll go. Had a lot to drink, so I went in there, and they immediately went after a carload of girls. I hung back. I thought, well, I have a few more drinks. I don't know about you, but the more I drink, then the cooler I get. And so I'm rehearsing some things that I need to know that I'm going to use when I make my approach. And so I had some things, about four of them, that I thought were just deadly, and was ready to go. So I go up to this car where my buddies were, but I notice the driver's not talking to anybody. So as I approach the driver, she looks at me, and I thought, wow, she's a good-looking girl. And I forgot everything I was going to say. And now I'm standing there with nothing to say, and she's looking at me with some slight look of expectation, and the only thing that came to mind was, you have the prettiest brown eyes I've ever seen. And not very deadly, but especially if it comes out like, oh, God, oh, God. And she looked at me, and I stood there and looked at her. I thought, you know, I could have peed on the side of a car, and she wouldn't have looked any different. And I just, and I turned around and walked away. I was embarrassed. I don't know if there's anything worse than being so drunk you can't talk, but you can still be embarrassed. And so I left. I thought, that's it. I'm not going back. I'll just drink. So I'm standing back there. And a little while later, she gets out of the car to go in the ladies' room. And I can see her really well. And I'm looking. And she's got turquoise shorts on, a really cute butt, nice legs, and those brown eyes, way more than I had on my list. And I'll tell you right now, I had an AA thought. Now, I wouldn't recognize it for about 29 more years, but I watched her walk in there, and I'm thinking, you know, I want what she has, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. And I did. The next day I was coming back with a cadet buddy, accidentally happened to see her and a girlfriend go into that very same place. Almost wrecked the car, skidding into the parking lot, walked in, and I was nervous, but at least I was sober. And they let us talk with them, buy them some coffee. Finally she gave me her name, and she said I could call her and date her. And I did, and on February the 25th of 1963, her 20th birthday... It's okay if I say that, isn't it? Because otherwise, I'd take it back. Yeah. She pinned my gold wings and my gold bars on me. And I'll tell you, it was a day that Hollywood couldn't have scripted any better. I have completed this program. I'm now a Marine aviator, naval aviator, a Marine, commissioned Marine Corps, second lieutenant. And the girl with the brown eyes was the one that went down the hill with me that night. So I think it's safe to ask her to please stand up at this point. Thank God she's not in the program and she doesn't work on character defects. And if she ever gets to where she could admit a mate, she made a mistake, I may be coming here by myself. But yeah. I just happen to know that being married 46 years is a little bit more than the average alcoholic marriage. I get. So, I got my wings, and she and I were married a few weeks later. And we launched on this journey. I went to California and joined one of the finest squadrons out there. Wrecked my car the first two happy hours in a row I was out there. No big deal. I wouldn't have any consequences. Anybody, that could happen to anybody. That was my lifelong argument for a long time. Hey, no big deal. It could happen to anybody. And I got in treatment. I started writing all this stuff down. I thought, well, it could. All these things could happen to anybody. They just couldn't happen to one person. She was instantly pregnant. We had a little baby boy out there. She was instantly pregnant again. 8 days, less than a year later, we had another little boy. And I was really getting tired. She was the youngest wife in the squadron. And I was really getting tired of people coming up and going, "You guys Catholic?" You know, I just kept starting. I started wondering, well, why do they think that only Catholics can do this? You know, I just say, "No, we're just a couple of horny Protestants. No, no problem with this." And so I headed out for Vietnam. We were one of the first squadrons over there, jet squadrons. So with one of the finest jet squadron I think it was ever put together in the Marine Corps. Went over there and flew under some very primitive conditions. We didn't have any booze over there at first, and which is probably good. But we flew under very primitive conditions. We were all carrier qualified. All our landings were on a little portable landing strip, carrier landings, jet assist takeoffs, and I did quite well. I've always done quite well. That's what I'm supposed to do. That's what my parents taught me to do. I'm supposed to work hard and do well. I'm supposed to work harder than you do. If I had an 8-to-5 job, I was supposed to be there at 7:45 and not leave until 5:15, no matter what you did. I was supposed to do everything in a way that reflected honor and pride and dignity on it. Whether I was putting on a Marine Corps uniform, airline uniform, representing my family, my heritage, my profession, I was supposed to do it and leave it bright and shiny. So that's why I had such a horrible time with the shame in the aftermath of this incident. But I came back from Vietnam. I lost some friends over there. I came back. I picked up some decorations. Was doing well. And reevaluated my Marine Corps career. I wanted to stay until I couldn't fly or until I died. But it was going to require another 4 to 6 years away from my family. And Barbara and I talked about family stuff. She knew about my family. And I promised her we would not have one of those. And she had never pressured me at all to get out. But I thought, I've got to get out if I'm going to be a father at all and not be gone for 4 to 6 years of my kids' lives. So I sat down and wrote a very painful letter of resignation. I'd gotten a regular commission in Vietnam. That's something I didn't think they would ever give somebody with a high school education. And they were very competitive at the time. And I got one. And 3 weeks after I resigned, a year later, I was in class at Northwest Airlines. I'd gone in the Marine Corps as a barely 18-year-old private, and I had come out 11 and a half years as a well-respected captain and a Marine fighter pilot with a good record and some commendations. That was what I was supposed to do. And for nearly 22 years at Northwest, I had about the same kind of a career. My drinking was picking up, and it was beginning to take over a little bit at a time. We got to the airline, and Barbara and I talked about adopting a little child even before we got married. And I said, let's either do it or let's not quit talking about it. We had the two boys, so we adopted this little Indian girl. And it was a tough struggle. It took us 14 months because of the biological kids that we already had. And we fought. We fought to get this little girl. And she came to live at our house, and she was 17 days old. Most beautiful little girl I've ever seen. And Barbara now had her daughter. And what I didn't know was what daughters do to their dads. And I learned very quickly. And she became the center of my universe. I loved her. And she couldn't walk past me without me saying, "Dawn, come over here and give me a hug." And I'd look into that beautiful little face and I'd say, "Thank you for being my girl." And she'd say, "Thanks for being my dad." And when she was 17, I thought we had perfect everything. Perfect career, perfect family, perfect neighborhood, perfect everything. So different from my childhood, so different from the way I'd grown up. Everything was perfect. And when she was 17, she ran away from home. And I didn't see it coming, nor did Barbara. I don't know if I'd not been drinking, if I'd seen it or not. One of the problems I had about being an alcoholic was I varied my drinking patterns deliberately. I didn't drink every night. Rarely ever drank in the mornings. 2 to 3 times a year, maybe. I just knew all of you guys drank every morning. I couldn't stay drunk for 3 days or 3 weeks. I knew you could. And then I would sometimes devise these little tests. I just pull informational data out of nowhere and I devise a test to see if I had a drinking problem, and you'll be surprised to know I passed them all. And never flunked one of them. And I'd always say, you know, no alcoholic can do that. I mean, the mere fact that I spend that much time checking myself is something most normal drinkers don't do that. So I don't know if I'd have seen this coming or not. I don't deny it, I just don't know. But I didn't handle it well. I had gone to Chicago to finally take a captain's test. I passed up for 2 years because I wanted to be home with Don. And when I was coming home the next day, Barbara answered the phone. I knew something was wrong. And she told me Don had run away, and I panicked. And I blurted out the places to go and the people to call and the where to go and check and see and all of these instructions to get my daughter back. And I got on the airplane in Chicago, and I was home in about 2 hours to Atlanta. And somewhere, somehow, along the way, in ways that I don't know, something changed. Because when I got off the airplane, I hated her. I hated her worse than I thought I had the capacity to hate. I hated her worse than I'd hated anyone or anything on the face of this planet. And I announced to Barbara that I didn't care if she died in the streets, that she would never, ever again come to my home. I told the rest of the family, do not ever breathe her name in my presence, ever. And within 2 days, all of her possessions were gone, to Goodwill or wherever. The finest detective couldn't have found a trace that she'd ever lived in my home. I went to the bank, ripped up her adoption papers. I went to an attorney, gave him $500 and disowned her. Then I tried to annul the adoption. I couldn't do that. And in the midst of this, in a way that will only appear insanely amusing, I self-assessed all of this and thought, you know, I think my wife's probably having a problem with this. We probably ought to get her a therapist. So by the luck of the draw, I plucked a name out of the phone book and got a good one. And we saw him twice a month for about 2 years. And I didn't like talking about my daughter, but I would go and we'd get through. The interesting thing was nothing ever came up about my drinking. Fascinating. And it wasn't because I had anything to hide. I didn't think I had a problem. I'd talk to you about my drinking anytime you want to talk about it. It just never came up. I'm amazed by that now. But one time something was being said about my daughter, and I made a statement that I had never consciously formed ever. And it so pictured and it so painted me. And I looked at this therapist and I said, I'm going to tell you something, doctor. I said, I would rather hate than hurt. And that's what I did. I spent a lifetime doing that. And he said to me, you survived a childhood doing that, and if you continue, it'll destroy you. And I've got all the ego and the arrogance of an airline captain, and I looked at him and I thought, I didn't say anything to him, but I know he could read my mind because I'm thinking, well, you may be a PhD family therapist, but I'm an airline pilot and I'll do it my way. And he was right. He was right about everything he told us throughout the entire thing. And that's pretty much where we were when this arrest and this incident happened. I drank hard and heavy over that. I think the progression probably picked up. Don is not responsible for my alcoholism. But I really hit the sauce after that. I really hit it. It is nothing for me to sit in a hotel room, lock that door and go down and go through a quart of booze in nothing flat. The problem I had was I wanted the relief. I wanted that warm, mellow feeling. I want that feeling that I can feel that goes all the way out to my fingertips, that easy, drifting away relaxation. I just don't care. Everything's okay. And I never got it. All I got was more hatred. It was like every time I took a drink of the alcohol, I dumped gasoline on the fire, and I've just blazed up, and it got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I hated more, and I hated more. And that's pretty much where we were when this arrest thing took place. I went into treatment, not wanting anybody to know who I was or what I was, and was suicidal in the first few days because it quickly broke on the news. Now everybody knew. Nobody knew the color of my eyes for a week or so. I wouldn't look up everywhere I went. I had my head down. I sat in the grooves with my head down. I could not look at you. I would not look at you. I would not talk to you. But things happen in treatment. And the good thing about my condition was that I was beat. I was done. I was all done. So I listened. I listened. And I hoped there was something to this 12-step stuff that I'm now starting to hear about. Because I've got nothing else to bank on or bet on. This has got to be it for me because I got nothing left. And so I invested in it very, very heavily. A week to the day that I went into treatment, the TV announced I wouldn't go near either one of the two TVs. I wouldn't go near them. But there's always a couple of patients whose designated duty is come report, and they do. So. A week to the day that I went in there, I'd been fired by Northwest, as I should have been. The FAA had issued an emergency revocation of all my flying certificates, as they should have. And I lost my FAA medical certificate based on a diagnosis of alcoholism, and that was fair also. Everything that happened to me all the way through was fair and appropriate. I'm a hardcore believer in acceptance of personal responsibility and the old axiom that when you do what you did, you get what you got. And that was fair. I didn't like it, but it was fair. Somewhere in the first week, I walked into a group therapy room not intending to talk, not intending not to talk. Talking was counterintuitive to me. And for some reason, they closed the door. There were 8 or 10 of us in there and began to talk about my daughter, and I broke down and cried. I hadn't done that before. I didn't even cry at my parents' funerals. It's not okay for me to cry. There's a cultural thing to it, but I can't cry. And I did. And it was one of the most important things that happened to me in treatment. It was one of the most important breakthroughs for me to be able to cry and to finally, for the first time ever, take the pain straight on. Not hide it, not shield it, not block it, but to take it and feel what it did to me. And I think I began doing some healing that day because then later I got a hold of Barbara and I said, get a hold of Dawn. She knew where she was. Let's put the family back together again. There was no visitors, no phone calls at this treatment center, but they considered it such an amazing breakthrough that they would allow it to occur if we could affect it. And a few days later, Dawn came up. And for the first time in 2 years, I walked into a day room of a treatment center and I saw my daughter. She was smaller than I remembered. And I cannot tell you what it felt like after this hatred to walk across that room and put my arms around my little girl and tell her how much I loved her instead of how much I hated her. And as I did so, I looked into her arms and there was a 5-month-old granddaughter. My daughter had gotten married. I didn't even know her last name. And I picked the little granddaughter up. She took my heart as quickly as my daughter had. First week of treatment and already good things are beginning to happen. But other things were happening also. Here came legal consequences. None of the attorneys had known anything about this. I knew FAA was going to react severely, and they did, but nobody knew anything about legal consequences. And every 2 to 3 days, they're taking me out of the group to give me the latest bad news, and it's just smothering me. It's taking my breath away from me. I can't breathe. The only time I was supposed to be in a jail or locked up was as a POW in Vietnam, not in an American jail or an American penitentiary. And the news, every time they give it to me, is worse. And I'm having to just try to collect myself and just try to breathe. And the final time, there were 6 of these events. And the final time they took me out, and there was a doctor there, and I thought, oh, God, there's never been a doctor before. And we went down to his office. He said, sit down. He said, I have to tell you, we've just gotten the word that a federal grand jury has indicted you, and you're looking at 15 years in federal prison, a $250,000 fine, and there's an attorney coming in Sunday and wants $50,000, which I didn't have. We went broke 30 days after the arrest. I'd grown up poor. I'd been used to being poor. I had hit it well. I'd hit the jackpot. I had lived the American dream. And now it was gone again. I deserved it, but Barbara didn't. My family didn't. As a result of what I had done, and now we're back to nothing again. He said, I have to ask you if you're going to hurt yourself. And I said, no. But I was numb. I went back to my room, and I don't remember collapsing, but I do remember with my head lying next to the carpet, I was crying again. And I said, God, I can't do this again. I can't do it even one more time. I just don't have anything left. Please help me. And I slept that night. I slept that night. Had it not been for the depth of this experience, I would not be sober. If God had left me anything to fight with or resist with, I would have fought to the death with it, and I would not be here tonight. And I have learned to be grateful for all of these things. I've learned to be grateful for everything that happened to me, because without those, the rest of the things could not have happened for me. I left the treatment center. I had many, many intense experiences in there that I don't have time to go into. Many of them. Life-changing experiences. I had worked as hard in there on this 12-step program as I had to get my wings. I had heavily, heavily invested. I was never out by the TV. I was reading. I read the big book through and through, over and over, the 12 and 12. I did every workbook, every exercise in the workbook that there was. Patients never did those. They did a couple of them. First step in the life story, but I did every one of them, because I didn't have any time to spend in front of the TV. I came out, I was quickly in a very public, heavily publicized trial in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And everywhere I went, there were reporters. There was no way to get anywhere without running in through a throng of reporters who were sticking cameras and microphones in my face trying to get a reaction. But you see, I had a large advantage. I didn't have much sobriety, but I'd worked hard for what I had. And I was the only alcoholic in that bunch. And I could go to AA meetings at night, and I did. And at first it was scary, because they always recognized me from the TV. And I never shared in the meetings. I just sat and listened and watched you. And I took what you gave me, and I took it to the courtroom the next day, and I got through the trial the next day. Criminal trials, amazing, indescribable. As I sat there day after day, listening to the prosecutor tell the world what a no-good piece of crap I was, always had been, and always would be. And it was printed. It was put everywhere. Sometimes I would look across the courtroom, and I would see Barbara, and our eyes would meet, and she would mouth the words, "I love you." And I'd nod, and I'd get through the rest of the day. Trial lasted 3 weeks. I watched the judge. The judge had strong feelings about this case, which I did not begrudge him. This was a horrific betrayal of the public trust. And we had drawn the toughest judge in the entire Minnesota district, which was consistent with my luck all the way through. I was quickly found guilty, as I knew it would be. Had an amazing story with this attorney I'd like to share with you, but can't in the interest of time. We went back a few months later, a couple of months later, for the sentencing. The sentencing guidelines were in place at the time. 12 months minimum, 18 months maximum. I knew I was going to get 18 months because I was the captain. I had made some degree of peace with that. And when we came back in, a day and a half before the trial, my attorney said, "I have to tell you something. I sensed something was wrong. I knew it." He said, "The judge has just notified all the attorneys and the media that he's going to depart upward from the sentencing guidelines. All the way up to 15 years is where he can go." And the prosecutor had not asked for this. This was something the judge felt strongly about, and I knew it was going to be bad. I'd felt that feeling of terror all the way through my bone marrow so many times, and here it came again. I recognized it. It was an old friend. I knew it. We walked out of there, and I said, "Step one, I'm powerless. I can't do anything about this. It's a matter of acceptance. I got to accept what's going to happen." And so I had been in treatment with a federal judge, and he used to corner me and tell me things that I just as soon not have heard. But one of them was, he said, "The sentencing is a charade." He said, "You're going to talk, a lawyer will talk." But he said, "None of that changes. When we come in from the bench, the sentence is set. So don't kid yourself that anything is going to change the last minute around." Judges and attorneys all over this country have corroborated that for me. So I knew nothing was going to change. He had his mind set. He had his mind made up, and this was going to happen. And as I stood to speak, even at that point in time, I didn't know what I was going to say because I was so scared. And I'd said, "Just let me get something out." So I talked about being grateful to be sober. I was grateful for what had happened inside my family. I had accepted responsibility for this incident from the very first. I couldn't change what happened yesterday. I couldn't change what happened some months back. To everybody's dismay, he announced a sentence on me of 16 months, 2 months less under the guidelines. A miracle took place in that courtroom that day. I thought I would never know why that happened. Several years later, the judge told my attorney, he said, I was going to sentence him to 4 years in prison that morning, until I looked at him and I thought about him and what he had said and what he had done, and I came down. That was a miracle. That was a miracle. Now, I wasn't real anxious to go dancing off into prison. But, you know, I've learned to live life on life's terms. The judge also surprised everybody else by saying, okay, I'm going to let you. I told Barbara I'd given her my personal effects and said, I think he will have us handcuffed and led away for the TV cameras because of the coverage. And he said, this is a first of its kind case, a lot of legal issues, never been used before. And he said, I'll let you three men remain free until all your appeals are exhausted. And the other two opted for that. I said, no, I'll go to jail now. I'll go to prison now. It's my time. He told my attorney, he said, no defendant before or after has ever done that. He said, initially, he said, it stunned me. I was lost for words. I told my attorney, I said, well, you wasn't lost very long. So on December the 5th, 1990, 34 years to the day that I'd entered Marine boot camp, I walked into the Atlanta federal prison system. I served 424 days in the federal prison system. I don't talk about it from the podium. It has nothing to do with my recovery. My recovery has everything to do with how I handle the prison system and that experience. I had a lot of things go on in there. And I'll just make two quick comments. There's two groups of really, really, really sick people out there, and the sickest group goes home every night. And you'll get that in a minute. Every now and then some prison guy comes out and goes, oh, I work out there and you hurt my feelings. And cuts me to the quick, of course. And I say, look, if you're in this fellowship, that does not apply to you. And if that doesn't suffice, then call your sponsor and don't bother me. The other thing was, I made 12 cents an hour out there. The thing that really upset me was there was no 401k plan. And, I came out of prison. I had a guy come up to me one time, and he goes, 424 days. Yeah. He said, that's nothing. He said, I was out there for 18 years. I just looked at him, smiled, and said, hey, well, I guess you win. It's a long time for me. Everything's different in there. Wind and the rain, everything is different in there. I came out of there, I was completely broken. The judge had put sanctions on me, hard sanctions to make sure I never flew again on top of what the FAA had done. He absolutely nailed my coffin shut. And another miracle of the story, and one that I don't have time to go into, about a year and a half later, he lifted those sanctions. Nobody thought that possible. I certainly didn't. But all I did was take one of the S's out of the word impossible, because the FAA said, if you want to fly again, you'll start right literally from the ground up with a private license. I'd never had a private license. I came out of the Marine Corps and was given a commercial with an instrument rating. Most of my friends, my pilot buddies, said that's not possible. Go back and literally do it from the ground up. Everything I've done within the framework of this story has been what I've learned in here. One day at a time, one thing at a time, one license at a time. And 10.5 months later, I had 4 licenses through nothing but hard work. No shortcuts, no quick fixes. But there's a flying component that comes with that, and I looked at it, and I thought, no way. $10,000, $20,000. I was working in the treatment center, the same one that I'd been in, with alcoholics and addicts, and I'm making $14,000 a year. I can't do that. Barbara's working in an office supply place. We're just barely staying alive. And I get a letter and a phone call from one of the Northwest pilots on the same evening. He said, I want you to come up here to Minnesota and go through my flight school, which I did not know he had, and I want you to do the flying for free and get those licenses back. I was under 13 conditions of probation. I went up there, checked in with the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and spent 44 days living with that man and his family. Rained out 14 days. It was a heavy monsoon rains during the summer of 93. But I just don't quit studying. I'm at the airport. I'm studying every day. I will not quit. And during the remaining 30 days, I flew 78 hours, and I got 4 licenses back. I had 2 of them one morning by 11:15, and I don't think that had ever been done before. I left there to come home, and I thought, that's great. I've got these licenses, but so what? Who's going to hire me? I'm the biggest pariah in all of commercial aviation. Everybody knows about Lyle Prouse and the Northwest Flight 650 incident. Never happened. Maybe if I can find a place in Africa, I hadn't had no TV and fly. About a month later, the licenses physically arrived in the mail, and I had a phone call within an hour of that. And it was from the head of the pilot union at Northwest. I had not challenged my termination. A grievance had been filed, but I didn't activate it because they were fair to fire me. I deserved what I got. They didn't fire me for being an alcoholic. They fired me for what I did, and it was fair. Pilate says to me, he said, this is the greatest phone call I've ever made, because 3 hours ago, he said, John Dasburg, president and CEO of Northwest Airlines, made a personal decision to bring you back and put you to work at Northwest Airlines in full flight status. And I had the tears again. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. This was beyond the level of extraordinary courage. What happened if I relapsed? He had just forfeited his CEO status and career to take that kind of a remarkable chance when 70% of us relapse. What happened if I had a flying incident? Why would he gamble? He had 50,000 employees. Why would he care about me? The answer is I don't know. And I've talked with him many times since then. Many times. I went back and we had a very emotional back to work ceremony. I was never to be a captain again. I said, that's okay. I've been a captain. I'm going to now end up with at least part of a retirement. I have not taken Barbara to a complete dead end, zero in the road. I'm overwhelmingly welcomed back by my peers. There will always be some that don't want us to get up, but they stay away. And I was told it was a small percentage. I don't know what that is, 2%, 5%, 10%, I don't know. Everywhere I went, people came up and said, hi, hello, I'm glad you're back. Six to a dozen every time I went on a trip. I'm now back. Northwest has a program because they got beat up pretty good over my deal. And I'm part of the program watching, helping young pilots come back and watching them get sober. But the miracles don't quit. My goal was to be the best employee they ever had. I was certainly the most visible. And I wanted to validate and vindicate the people who had taken such a horrific chance on me. And that was my goal every day I went to work. And as I approached my final year at Northwest, I received another phone call. The president and CEO of Northwest Airlines had again changed his mind and thought I should end my career as a 747 captain. And I went back and I checked out. I went back and I checked out as a 747 captain. I spent the last full year completely restored, given all the trust and dignity back. And I flew a mega-million-dollar airplane all over the world from the left seat, in charge, trusted, and restored. Last year, last fall, I spoke at a large gathering just outside of Chicago, and sitting in the front row was Judge James M. Rosenbaum and his wife and family. Only an AA. I retired honorably at the mandatory retirement age of 60, September 98. As I did so, within days, I received a phone call from my attorney, now my friend, and he said, Judge Rosenbaum has just told me that in 16 years, he has never supported a petition for pardon, but he'll support yours if you want to try. I'd never considered trying for a pardon. I put in the papers. The judge wrote a 3-page affidavit that is so chokingly, emotionally powerful that I cannot read it from page 1 to page 3 without having tears in my eyes, and I've read it at least 30 times. And 2 years later, I came walking in and there were 8 phone messages congratulating me on just having received a presidential pardon. That is a huge life-altering event for somebody with a felony conviction. So if you're new here, I want to tell you that on the second day I was in treatment, I sat in a meeting and I heard the readings for the first time, and I heard the promises. And I began to listen to the promises, hoping that there was something to them. Why would they read these? And then they got down to the part that said, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see our experience can benefit others. And I thought, no, I think I'm going to get sober, but none of those things can ever happen for me. And you haven't even heard about 70% of the miracles that I've gotten to experience. I want to close with something that I heard Father Martin do one time. Now, I'm not trying to be Father Martin. I just like the sentiment. As a matter of fact, he said he'd gotten it from somebody who sent him a card, he copied it too. Wonderful guy. I got to go out there to his place a number of times out at Ashley, but it addresses life as I see it and as I believe it to be, and says, I do not wish you joys without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you strength, faith, love, and wisdom, and goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My name is Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for being here.